statements like this to the Khalifa until the latter was convinced about killing the Imam alayhi salam. Eventually, they poisoned the Imam. You see how the head judge became corrupted because of envy, and that led him to inflict harm upon the Wali of Allah, the friend of Allah, Imam Muhammad al-Jawad alayhi salam, and eventually poisoned him.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor 'cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Understanding reality will not come from reading books alone, dear brothers and sisters. And this is another subtopic within the topic of envy. Understanding reality will not come from reading books alone. Look and see how many scholars from different fields are in danger of this trait, envy. You see doctors, engineers, and scientists, they are all in danger of this disease which is called envy. But the knowledge that has been praised in the Quran and traditions is a light that shines in one's heart. An example of this is the scholars are the inheritors of the prophets. This knowledge, the knowledge of reality, the knowledge of the mortality of this world and the immortality of the next, is not achieved by reading alone. It is a light that is given by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to a person who has prepared himself to receive it. How do you prepare yourself? By reaching that elevated status where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gives you ilham, gives you inspiration, divine inspirations, where you will see the truth, or you will feel resentment against these kind of traits. You will not allow these kind of traits to enter your character, and you will try to eliminate all those traits which are negative, and which what we call negative traits, radha'il. And when you have done so, dear brothers and sisters, you will see the illumination coming from within you. When you have reached the level where you are conscious and aware that this is my nafs, my ego, this envy is feeding my nafs right now. This anger is feeding my nafs right now. This lust is feeding my nafs right now. Only then, when you have reached this awareness, can you determine what to do and decide what steps you should take to reach your goal and eliminate these diseases. And if you cannot do it alone, please do ask help. Do go to someone who can help you. call that person, go to that person who can help you to eliminate these disease. And we should check ourselves, and I have said it in previous programs also, as you go and check yourself with a doctor, you should check yourself with a spiritual doctor. If you go and check what your spiritual diseases are, only then can you also find the remedy for it. Before you reach a calamity, before you reach and do things where you never could imagine. So let us try, dear brothers and sisters, to practice this in our daily life. As soon as we feel that envy coming within us and trying to take over our nafs, and our thoughts tries to concentrate only on that topic. Why did he get promoted and I didn't? Why did my friend get accepted in this university and I didn't? And so on and so forth. Try to stop it there. Think about the present. Not about the past. Not about the future, but about the present. Control your thoughts, and inshallah ta'ala we will talk more about this topic in coming programs here for a better life on IRIB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Your mercy, your love is all I need.
Love is all I need.
So all I need.
Love is all I need.
So all I need.
Love is all I need.
All I need.
Love is all I need.
Oh.
All I need to be all
so
I can
be,
and I know that you see how much you need to me. Cause your love is all I need to be all I can be, and I know that you see how much you need to me. Cause your love is all I need.
Your love is all I need.
Round the world with reporters. Despite the apparent demise of the Trump era, it is clear that the far-right movement in the West is still alive and well. White supremacy, racism, and xenophobia are problems in every EU country.
But this is the end! It's the end! Enough's enough!
Coordinated by the European Commission Brussels, religious leaders from all of the main faiths have just taken part in a video conference.
Reports of anti-Semitic and anti-Muslim attacks are now almost part of everyday life in our beloved Europe.
The leaders say the answer is to show more unity and greater mutual respect.
I want to say that if somebody hurts a Muslim sister, a Jewish brother, they are hurting me.
The European Union's much criticized asylum policy also came under the spotlight during the event.
Europe loses its soul if we continue to watch people drowning in the Mediterranean. That is why we support civil rescue missions.
Religious leaders insist the European Union must do more to ensure refugees play a positive and productive role in society. Experts agree.
There were mistakes in integration of the migrants, and there were mistakes in education, or lack of education, or lack of access to the educational system.
In the past, Saudi Arabia has been criticized for sponsoring terrorism in the EU. The European Commission says it is easier to brainwash vulnerable young men when they do not feel part of a community.
This sense of belonging would be the best shield against radicalization, terrorism, and hatred.
Work is continuing to try and curtail terrorist recruitment online in the EU. However, sociologists believe that is not the root cause of the security issue.
They say the source of the problem is not the internet, but the current climate within society. The focus should be on changing that, they argue. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
after a long hunger strike going beyond 100 days to protest against his detention. Without charge or trial, Palestinian prisoner Maher al-Akhras has been finally freed. The Israeli authorities released al-Akhras from the Israeli hospital of Qablan, where he was held for subsequent worsening of his health condition. He arrived at al-Najah hospital in the West Bank city of Nablus following his release by Israeli authorities. After final medical examinations, he was moved to his hometown, Silat al-Dahr, north of the occupied West Bank. In a press statement, al-Akhras thanked the Palestinian people for the solidarity actions and insisted that gaining rights and liberty are only achieved through fighting.
Praise be to God that I am now among my family and my people in Nablus, and that, God willing, we will get rid of the occupation with the mighty wills of our people and live from victory to victory until we reach a greater victory and liberate Palestine.
Israel arrested al-Akhras in July over accusations of being a prominent member of the Jihad resistance group, which he denied. He immediately started his hunger strike, demanding that he should either be prosecuted for clear charges or be released. Israel at first refused to deal with his demands, but when he was at the verge of death, the Israeli High Court ruled that if al-Akhras ended his hunger strike, his administrative detention would not be renewed upon its expiration on 6th of November. Prominent figures who rushed to welcome al-Akhras praised his encouragement in what they described as defeating the occupation's authorities. Administrative detention involves no indictment, no revelation of confidential evidence, and no trial or judgment of the accusations against the prisoner. Hundreds of Palestinian prisoners are languishing in Israel's jails without charge or trial under the illegal so-called administrative detention. The inmates say their hunger strike is a bet to have their voice heard and to force the Israeli regime to end this illegal policy. Reports say more than 7,000 Palestinians are held in Israeli jails. Maher al-Akhras has achieved victory through his hunger strike, and he's free today. Experts say his battle definitely gives other Palestinian prisoners under administrative detention a glimmer of hope, enabling them to go on with their actions and their fight for justice that aim to get back their rights in Israeli jails. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
The UN Conference on Trade and Development, UNCTAD, said in a report that Israel's prolonged blockade of the Gaza Strip and the regime's military operations against the Palestinian enclave had inflicted some $17 billion U.S. dollars in losses between 2007 and 2018. Richard Guzel-Wright, the director of UNCTAD's Globalization and Development Strategy, said that it was extremely difficult to see anything but redevelopment being the fate of Gaza society. The Israeli regime has placed the Gaza Strip under a tight blockade since 2007 and waged three wars on it since 2008. The blockade and military operations had driven the poverty rate in Gaza to increase almost fourfold compared with normal conditions.
The losses that were highlighted in the UNCTAD report show the extent of damage caused by the Israeli blockade and wars against the Gaza Strip, especially the three major wars since 2008. Israel has systematically destroyed civilian infrastructure and economic sectors, in addition to the loss of innocent lives.
According to the UNCTAD report, Gaza has witnessed one of the worst economic performances globally. In addition to killing and maiming thousands of Gazans during the wars, Israeli forces also bombed civilian infrastructure, as well as thousands of factories and businesses.
The Palestinian economy in Gaza is collapsing because of the Israeli wars and blockade. Israel waged three major wars in less than 10 years and destroyed all aspects of our economy in Gaza.
As day laborers, we sustained heavy losses because of the wars. Factories were destroyed during the wars, and thousands of people lost their sources of income.
UNCTAD says its estimates are partial because they cover only the economic cost of the Israeli occupation, from the prolonged closure and recurrent military operations in Gaza from 2007 to 2018. Experts say the Israeli regime must be held accountable for its illegal policies against the Palestinian people.
Israeli military aggressions and the blockade amount to war crimes, and the international community must bring an end to Israel's impunity. The Palestinian Authority and human rights organizations must also include the economic file in their complaints at the International Criminal Court because Israel perpetrated war crimes and crimes against humanity.
Observers say that for Gaza's economy to slightly recover, the blockade must be fully lifted. According to UN figures, the Israeli regime is responsible for the near collapse of Gaza's regional economy and its isolation from the Palestinian economy and the rest of the world. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Sudan's former premier Sadr al-Mahdi dies from the novel coronavirus at the age of 84. Al-Mahdi was Sudan's last democratically elected prime minister, who was transferred to the United Arab Emirates for treatment but succumbed to the illness nonetheless. The government declared 3 days of national mourning for his passing. Al-Mahdi was born in 1935 in the city of Omdurman and grew up during the last 2 decades of British imperial rule on Sudan. He became the country's prime minister in 1966, but his term did not last long as he was ousted in 1967 by a coalition of defectors. Later in 1986, al-Mahdi was elected again as premier, but was toppled once more in 1989 by former ruler Omar al-Bashir in a military coup. The post of prime minister of Sudan was then abolished. Since his ouster, al-Mahdi continued to lead the Umma Party, one of the largest opposition movements during Bashir's era, and spent a period in exile, but eventually returned to Sudan in the year 2000. He threw his weight behind the mass protest movement that eventually prompted the military to overthrow the president last year. After Bashir's ouster, al-Mahdi pushed for a transfer to civilian rule, warning of the risks of a counter-coup and calling for the powerful paramilitary rapid support forces to be integrated into the army. Al-Mahdi was also against the normalization of ties with Israel and supported the axis of resistance against the regime. In October, he slammed US President Donald Trump's announcement that Sudan would start normalizing ties with Israel. Al-Mahdi stressed that Trump's statement contradicts the Sudanese national law and contributes to the elimination of the peace process in the Middle East. He accused Trump of being racist against Muslims and described Israel as an apartheid regime. However, Sudan became the third Arab country to normalize ties with Israel after the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain in August. Al-Mahdi warned that normalizing ties with Tel Aviv will prepare the ground for the ignition of a new war.
Cafes, restaurants in Catalonia are back in business after a prolonged coronavirus shutdown that impacted thousands of businesses, pushing angry workers out on the streets in protest. Following a sustained decrease in the daily number of COVID-19 cases, the regional government scrambled to improve a plan to reopen the economy unveiled last week by increasing operating hours and adding concert halls to the list of businesses that can reopen.
We are very happy to be back to work and hope this is the last time we shut down because it will be the end for our business. I cried every day when I was out of work because I have a family to feed. We are worried. We can't fail this time.
Under the new guidelines, food service businesses are able to operate indoors at 30% occupancy, while they can serve at full capacity on terraces, provided they keep a 2-meter distance between tables. The 4-phase reopening is expected to last 2 months, with a gradual lifting of restrictions on movement inside of the Spanish northeastern region. A 10 p.m. curfew will stay in place for several weeks as the situation in hospitals and intensive care units remains critical. Meanwhile, authorities have launched massive antigen testing campaigns across the region in a bid to control the spread of the virus.
The antigen rapid test detects COVID-19 virus using a nasal swab. It offers a highly reliable result within 15 minutes, and it is one of the most cost-effective tests on the market right now.
Although test sensitivity for rapid antigen testing is generally lower than for the standard PCR, authorities are pushing for their deployment, arguing they could be useful in detecting highly infectious people. With a population of 7.5 million, Catalonia has registered over 300,000 cases of COVID-19 and over 15,000 deaths since the start of the pandemic.
The reopening of the economy in Catalonia is fraught with its fair share of risk and reward for everyone involved. It will take at least 2 weeks to find out if the second shot at the virus was successful. The stakes for the food service, hospitality, entertainment, and sports industries have never been higher. Kusai Kadri, Barcelona.
The coronavirus crisis has highlighted just how vulnerable the EU is when it comes to even the most basic healthcare requirements, such as having enough face masks. The bloc has also had to import ventilators and medication, mostly from China. The European Commission has just unveiled a pharmaceutical strategy aimed at making the EU less dependent.
We do not want to see, never again, the problems that we faced during the first weeks of the pandemic. Never again.
The plan is to ensure essential items are manufactured within the EU. The European Commission is also concerned that EU nations will not be ready to distribute vaccines when they become available in the coming weeks. Just half of the bloc's 27 nations have published plans. Countries are being told to redouble their efforts.
This means that member states need to have the necessary infrastructure and the logistics, so when there is a safe and effective vaccine, they can roll it out and deploy it as quickly as possible.
Businesses are buckling under the pressure of lockdowns in many EU countries. The run-up to the December and January holiday period is normally their most profitable time. EU leaders continue to squabble over much-needed financial support packages for employers.
We've seen a major shock to the whole of the euro area, major trouble in Spain, in Italy, in other countries. I think the response was too weak.
Officials warn that if COVID-19 restrictions are relaxed too soon, hospitals will be overwhelmed during early 2021. It appears to be an impossible health-economy balancing act for governments. There is concern we are becoming complacent because we know vaccines are coming. Equally, authorities are worried too few of us will take advantage of the scientific breakthrough.
The European Centre for Disease Control says each year hundreds of thousands of healthcare workers in the EU refuse to take the seasonal flu vaccine. It begs the question how many of them, and how many people in general, will agree to be injected with a COVID-19 vaccine. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Arrivals on the Canary Islands have surged. Almost 17,000 people have reached their shores so far this year, more than 10 times last year's total, and hundreds have died trying. The Spanish government has promised to set up camps and shelters for more than 7,000 people, but overwhelmed local authorities and activists say the migrants are being treated with contempt.
The majority of migrants who are arriving are returnable, or expellable, if we may say. They are not candidates that apply to our reception system. Our reception system is tailored for vulnerable people and people who have asked for international asylum.
Over in France, images of homeless migrants camped out on a Paris square being evacuated by police have caused outcry, forcing lawmakers to comment on the situation that seems far from under control.
Cette manifestation était-elle autorisée?
Was this event authorized? Was it legal? The answer is no. Should we have left on the Place de la République hundreds of tents, hundreds of people without evacuating them? The answer is no. Was I, like you or others, shocked to see some images on social media of evacuation? Proof that this is a free country? Of course.
Ceux qui n'ont rien, pas même à toi.
Those who have nothing, not even a roof over their heads, shelter themselves symbolically under the statue symbolizing the Republic to call for fundamental rights. They were peaceful. The order was given for them to be evacuated at any cost, although they did not represent any threat at all.
Immigration to Europe is fueled by wars and economic instability in which Europe is complicit. The bloc's exploitation of resources and interventionism goes on around the globe, and countries like Britain sell arms to almost all regimes deemed violators of human rights. To stop migrants setting out in the first place, millions of euros are also pumped into countries like Libya, a conduit for African migrants, and end up in the hands of militiamen, traffickers and Coast Guard members who imprison and torture thousands of migrants. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The latest challenges in the Muslim world. This is the main theme of the gathering, attended by political activists. On top of the conference's agenda was the French government's recent blasphemy to Prophet Muhammad, which triggered worldwide condemnation from Muslims and religious leaders.
Insulting the Prophet of Islam is tantamount to blasphemy against all other religions. The divine books of Christianity and Judaism both speak highly of the last prophet named Muhammad. Religions don't have any issues with each other. As a Jewish scholar, I believe what the French president said against Islam is unacceptable. He has ignored the sentiments of around 2 billion people.
Delegates also condemned Sudan, Bahrain, and the United Arab Emirates for their normalization of ties with Israel. Last month, Sudan became the fifth Muslim country after Bahrain, the UAE, Egypt, and Jordan to establish diplomatic ties with Israel. Delegates at the conference called it a strategic folly and a backstabbing of Palestinians who have been suffering under more than 7 decades of Israel's occupation.
Those treacherous regimes have never cared about the interests of Muslims. They only seek to consolidate their foothold as rulers. I'm sure that the people of Bahrain, the UAE, and Sudan do not share the stance of their regimes toward Israel. Muslims will never recognize Israel and its occupation of Palestine.
Although the Arab-Israeli détente infuriated the Muslim world, activists say it should not come as a surprise and is solely a revelation of their long-standing covert ties. This is why they believe the move will not lead to a seismic shift in regional power balance.
Experts here find the root cause of regional crises in lack of coordination and a growing chasm between regional states. They say external players such as the U.S. never want this gap to be bridged, since such a division has long been a chance for them to serve their interests in the region. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
In an official visit to Afghanistan, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh is seeking to boost ties between Kabul and Tehran via expanding mutual cooperation, mainly in terms of peace and security.
Security of Afghanistan is of a high priority. We think that the security of two nations, Iran and Afghanistan, are very much connected to each other. So we think that through collaboration, through cooperation, we have to be able to secure a stable situation in Afghanistan.
The visit of Iran's foreign ministry spokesman comes as many here believe Afghanistan is entering a new phase, and that is why players like Iran are struggling to keep their role in the country's peace and security.
Afghanistan is entering a new phase, and all regional players have developed new plans in line with their own interests. For instance, Daesh is replacing the Taliban in Afghanistan. The visit of Iran's foreign ministry spokesman to Kabul proves Iran's effort to expand its role in Afghanistan's security.
The visit of Iran's delegation comes as Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan visited Kabul last week.
The recent political trips of Afghanistan's eastern and western neighbors to Kabul are a proof of importance of the country to them. That is especially at a time when insecurity is on the rise and negotiations are underway between the Afghan government and the Taliban to bring a lasting peace to the war-torn nation. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Climate heating gases have reached record levels in the atmosphere despite the global lockdowns caused by the coronavirus pandemic, the UN's World Meteorological Organization has said. There is estimated to have been a cut in emissions of between 4.2% and 7.5% in 2020 due to the shutdown of travel and other activities. But the WMO said this was a tiny blip in the continuous buildup of greenhouse gases in the air caused by human activities and less than the natural variation seen year to year. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Kenny Stencil Ryder. This article is published under the heading No Time to Lose for Climate Action. Atmospheric CO2 continued to rise in 2020 despite COVID-19 lockdowns. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. The COVID-19 pandemic provoked a global economic slowdown that led to a slight reduction in carbon dioxide emissions in 2020, but this year's drop has had no measurable impact on the ongoing buildup of heat-trapping gases in the atmosphere. That's according to a new report published on Monday, November 15th, by the United Nations World Meteorological Organization, WMO, which advocated for responding to the climate emergency with bold action that includes a thorough reconfiguration of economic, energy, and transportation systems. While the coronavirus-driven restrictions on commerce have been a life-saving public health intervention, the lockdown-related fall in emissions is just a tiny blip on the long-term graph, said WMO Secretary General Petteri Tallas. The report estimated that as a result of the temporary shutdown of air travel and other activities, the total reduction of annual global greenhouse gas, that is GHG emissions, in 2020 will be between 4.2% and 7.5%. But that has had a negligible impact on GHG concentrations, the result of cumulative past and current emissions. CO2 remains in the atmosphere for centuries, Tallas pointed out, meaning that actions taken this year to curb the spread of a deadly infectious disease are not a solution for climate change. As Greece reported in April, the world is still on track to release 95% of the carbon dioxide emitted in a typical year, even as we are stuck at home. One reason why is that, as Matt Huber explained on the Unequal Carbon Footprints website, The bulk of emissions are generated by the industrial sector operated by very large and profitable corporations. If we are going to solve climate change, Haber added, we should start by thinking about how to reform the behaviors of these actors first. Although the global response to the pandemic is not an adequate way to approach the climate emergency, it does provide us with a platform for more sustained and ambitious climate action to reduce emissions to net zero through a complete transformation of our industrial, energy, and transport systems, Tala said. As The Guardian reported recently, scientists calculate that emissions must fall by half by 2030 to give a good chance of limiting global heating to 1.5 centigrade, beyond which hundreds of millions of people will face more heat waves, droughts, floods, and poverty. Talos stressed that achieving carbon neutrality is economically affordable and technically possible and would affect our everyday life only marginally. There is no time to lose, he added. In a video based on the findings of the report also released recently, the WMO repeated its no time to lose for climate action message as it called for strong efforts worldwide to address the emission crisis. We need to stop the emissions and keep the fossil fuels in the ground, tweeted scholar activist David Fopp. CO2 concentrations are going up and will continue to increase, he noted. Unless we stop the fossil fuel society and replace it with a just and humane global democracy. Methane, which is produced by cattle, rice paddies, and fossil fuel exploitation, is responsible for 17% of the heating effect. Its concentration is now 2.5 times pre-industrial levels. Another important greenhouse gas is nitrous oxide, which comes from overuse of farm fertilizer and forest burning. It is now 23% higher than in 1750. The greenhouse gas data is collected by the Global Atmosphere Watch Network, which includes stations in the Arctic, high mountains, and tropical islands. They have continued to operate despite COVID-19 restrictions, hampering resupplies and rotation of staff in often harsh and isolated locations.
Aperture.
Welcome back, everyone. We witness how, cloaked in the shadows of the light of public scrutiny, the Bilderberg Group began to form their own self-serving agendas and wielded their immense power and resources to redesign the world in their vision. Yet, today, this old institution faces a new climate thanks to a new wave of savvy investigative journalists who attempt to peel away the secret history and ongoing influence of this organization. Don't go away, here's the next part.
Former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger has been deeply involved in the Bilderberg Group, attending dozens of their meetings over the years and acting on the Bilderberg Steering Committee. Kissinger faces allegations of war crimes for his involvement in the secret bombing campaign that took place in Cambodia during the Vietnam War in the 1970s. It is alleged that Kissinger willfully engaged in the murder of tens of thousands of civilians in various areas of Cambodia, which led to the destabilization of the country into a civil war, resulting in the rise of the infamous Khmer Rouge. Kissinger is also wanted in several countries for his involvement in supporting the Pinochet regime and the CIA-backed coup that took place in Chile on September 11, 1973. Pinochet, who is now facing a war crimes tribunal, murdered the democratically elected President Salvador Allende and started a military junta, which resulted in the kidnapping, forced displacement, and torture of thousands of men, women, and children in Chile. Henry Kissinger actively supported these actions that were taking place at that time, which constituted crimes against humanity. Kissinger was also involved in a controversial study in 1974 called National Security Study Memorandum 200, in which the basic thesis called for an active campaign for the depopulation of several less developed countries to stem the risk for civil unrest.
Are you still giving out orders like Memorandum 200, where you said depopulation should be hell? Sir, just a question. I'm not going to go to hell, because... Memorandum 200, sir?
Where did you...
Memorandum 200? Just ask him a question about Memorandum 200 that he wrote in April 24, 1974. It's an honest question. Okay.
We're on topic.
Kissinger, Memorandum 200. Depopulation.
We're on topic now. We came here, we give you the access. You want to burn bridges, you can do that.
I don't want to burn any bridges. I didn't. I wasn't disrespectful. I wasn't accusatory. It was a serious question.
We're on topic.
Okay, I understand that. So what about the depopulation? I mean, Memorandum 200. Why are you afraid to talk about your depopulation plan?
Why don't you get lost?
Why should I get lost? It's serious.
Sick
person. How am I sick? You're the one committing...
I hope it's the beginning of a whole new epoch of greater and greater coverage. At the same time, we're in danger because of their designs on the internet. This could also be the high watermark. It really depends on who stands their ground and what the fight will be. Because, of course, we've just broke last week. People from the European Commission, the Dutch woman, Neelie Kroes, wants a mandatory internet ID for Europe. Cybercom, we saw the Stuxnet virus, admittedly engineered from the U.S. and Israeli and other related allies to use against Iran and so forth. On that pretext, they want to take greater and greater control of the web. The United Nations also trying to have a reach over the web.
The Bilderberg Group include many prominent members of the internet and computing world, including National Security Agency Director and Chief of the United States Cyber Command, General Keith B. Alexander, co-founder of Facebook, Chris Hughes, founder of PayPal and chief Facebook investor, Peter Thiel, executive chairman of Google, Eric Schmidt, founder of Amazon, Jeff Bezos, co-founder of LinkedIn, Reid Hoffman, vice president, European Commission, commissioner for digital agenda, Neelie Kroes, chief research and strategy officer, Microsoft Corporation, Craig J. Mundy, and many others.
More and more, we're seeing the Iron Curtain of media censorship on Bilderberg and the shadow government, shadow elite, pulled back. So we're seeing Bilderberg basically try to pass the baton off to younger people right now, a bunch of tech folks, Google, Facebook, and others, hoping that the police state tech grid can protect their criminal activity. They're trying to push a global bank as the solution to all our problems that they created. They're openly trying to push more police state systems. They want to end internet freedom. They want to bring in internet IDs.
The mainstream media is no longer mainstream. The alternative is taking over, and they're trying their damnedest to either restrict or shut down the free internet as we know it right now.
The increase of internet-based media has been closely correlated with the decrease of traditional forms of media, such as newspapers and television, which have been monopolized by members of the Bilderberg Group. In their efforts to maintain the control of information globally, influential figures of the media have been routinely invited to participate in the conferences over the years. Peter Mansbridge of CBC's The National attended the meeting in 2010 and has maintained their strict rules for secrecy ever since. Fellow Canadian Heather Reisman is the CEO of Indigo Books, the largest book supplier in Canada, and she is a member of the Bilderberg Steering Committee. In 2005, Reisman founded the Hesseg Foundation, which provides grants to former lone soldiers in the Israeli Army to pursue post-secondary education. A lone soldier is an individual who is not from Israel, but chooses to fight in the Israeli military. Other media moguls and organizations that have attended the Bilderberg meetings over the years have included Rupert Murdoch of News Corporation, Andrew Knight of News Corporation and The Economist, Ted Turner of Time Warner and CNN, Charlie Rose, Donald Graham of The Washington Post, and Canadian media baron and former Bilderberg Steering Committee member Conrad Black of Hollinger International and The Telegraph newspaper. While all of these powerful media organizations have been present at Bilderberg meetings over the years, there has remained a media blackout all across the board regarding coverage of this group.
Hi. Hi. I was just wondering what your opinions were. You talk a little bit about it in the book of the influence of the Bilderberg group on the mainstream media, or on just the influence.
The individuals are influential, but their influence isn't magnified by Bilderberg. I went for 20 years. Mm-hmm. It's just a talking shop, and they're almost always wrong, by the way. They didn't see the end of the Cold War coming. They didn't see the economic crisis coming. They're very interesting meetings. They're very interesting people, but they're not coherent. They aren't a group that meets other than for 3 days a year, and the composition of them changes all the time, except for about 30 of us who are on the steering committee.
And how come?
Don't buy into these conspiracy theories. It's rubbish. All they do is talk to each other. I was on that conference circuit for 20 years, the Trilateral Commission, and I went to all of them. And look, it was fine while it lasted, but I'm getting too old for that. I'm getting tired.
Okay.
You know.
All right, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks. Right. But there's no conspiracy with any of them.
No.
But no, there's a bunch of people.
How come you never hear about it in the media? Like, I only read about it in your book.
They don't allow the media.
No.
But in order to encourage people to talk frankly, which you do, you get good, frank sessions. But there's no meeting of the minds particularly.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Fellow Hollinger International Board of Directors member Marie-Josée Kravis has made significant inroads since being invited to Bilderberg by Conrad Black in 1989. Marie-Josée is the wife of Bilderberg member Henry Kravis and has been a member of the Bilderberg Steering Committee for over 22 years. At the trial of the now-defunct media baron Conrad Black, Marie-Josée Kravis testified against him, providing evidence for the prosecution. Other prominent Canadians who have attended the Bilderberg conferences include former Prime Minister of Canada Lester B. Pearson, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, Jean Chrétien, Paul Martin, and Stephen Harper. Many other influential Canadian politicians and business leaders have also attended the secret meetings, including former NDP leader Bob Rae, former Liberal Party leaders Stéphane Dion and Michael Ignatieff, former Premier of Ontario Mike Harris, former Premier of New Brunswick Bernard Lord, former Premier of British Columbia Gordon Campbell, the Premier of Alberta Alison Redford, the Chief of Staff for Prime Minister Stephen Harper Nigel S. Wright, and Power Corporation of Canada CEO Paul Desmarais Sr. In fact, nearly every Canadian Prime Minister back to Pierre Elliott Trudeau has worked for Power Corp.
In 1996, you were at a Bilderberg meeting, and also there was Jean Chrétien and Paul Martin.
I don't know if I was at that meeting. I've only been to a few of them, but I Bilderberg and Trilateral are not really think tanks. They simply individuals who get together who are from business, the political world, the media, others, and discuss ideas, and they influence each other through that.
Shortly after Dan and Steve got back from the Bilderberg meeting in Chantilly, I decided to file some Access to Information Act requests for information on both Alison Redford, the Premier of Alberta, and for Nigel S. Wright, who is the Chief of Staff for Prime Minister Stephen Harper. I received two notices. One was for Nigel S. Wright, and it actually revealed very little. They just said that they didn't have any record of him having attended the Bilderberg meeting in Chantilly, even though he was on the official attendees list. In 2011, the Harper government decided to amend the Access to Information Act and privacy request forms, making it so that anybody that was on the Prime Minister's cabinet was exempt from releasing any personal information. In the case of Alison Redford, the Premier of Alberta, I did receive actually quite a big disclosure from their executive council office in Alberta. 31 pages were disclosed to me just the other day. All sorts of different pages have notices to destroy these emails, do not release this information to the public, do not release any information about your travel itinerary prior to attending the meeting. But a lot of the stuff is redacted. A lot of this information is redacted out. That's cited under different sections of the Privacy Protection Act, which is goes hand in hand with the Access to Information Act request. So any other information that was in there about other people has been redacted out. There's also a page in here that describes the nature of the meetings off the record. Fruitful discussions are enhanced by an atmosphere of mutual trust in which participants can express themselves freely. All discussions are therefore private and off the record. The press is excluded from the meetings. A list of participants will be released to the press on the eve of the conference. There's nothing to hide. If you're doing good things, you don't have anything to hide. There's only something to hide if you don't want people hearing what you're saying. That's the only reason to say it off the record, is that you wouldn't want to be quoted on something that could be damaging to your career.
The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. We decided long ago that the dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts far outweighed the dangers which are cited to justify it. And there is very grave danger that an announced need for increased security will be seized upon by those anxious to expand its meaning to the very limits of official censorship and concealment.
How do you feel about secrecy in government?
It's a scary thing. I mean, it's secret, so I don't really know much about it.
I can understand if the secrecy is for national security, but, you know, secrecy and covering up, you know, financial documents and things like that, I think as taxpayers, you know, we have the right to know what's going on in our government.
I think secrecy is pretty inherent in the Canadian government, for sure, and in all government. I wish it wasn't that way. I wish government was completely democratic, which would mean that we would be a part of it. But seeing as, like, we have representatives in this House deciding on issues for us, secrecy kind of just comes with that.
I honestly don't think it's a good idea for anybody to be secret. I don't think anything should be secret. I think if anything needs to be said, it needs to be said in front of the people here that can hear it.
We elect people to govern us in a democratic way. And when those people fall, you know, prey to, you know, individuals that have money or, you know, have leverage on them, it's no different than a dictatorship. When you have, like, government officials and then you have financiers and, like, heads of, like, banks meeting behind closed doors, that's already against the law.
We have really no idea. And without you guys, we wouldn't be around to know, so.
The more independent media that covers events like this or like anything gives a more unbiased opinion, considering how slanted our current media is.
It doesn't have to be a, you know, massive media tycoon that's controlling what's being said anymore. You know, the average person can do it, right? Which is, I mean, you know, that's an amazing feat. We didn't have that 50 years ago. We didn't have that at all.
It's time to get it out there. We should at least know.
Almost everybody here has a camera. They're all doing live streaming. They're all, you know, interviewing people. I mean, there is just everywhere from, you know, really big names with big websites to just people doing their own little thing. And it's crazy. I mean, everybody has a camera this year.
We live in the time of intelligence, of technology, of instant information. And more these people are realizing that, and they're going to realize that today with the hundreds of people that are surrounding the Marriott Hotel where Bilderberg 2012 is being held.
What do you think about, you know, the independent media's these days' ability to use social media and live streaming at these kinds of events?
It's amazing, and it shows you how many people that are getting aware and politically aware to this.
And everyone's becoming the independent media because of the double-edged sword that is social media. It's also, of course, a spy tool, as everyone knows.
They're worried about us. They're worried about you. They're worried about every person out here with a cell phone that's able to broadcast live or put the video online, where in the decades past it would require an entire news crew, an assignment, tens of thousands of dollars worth of equipment. Now we can do it standing out here with a cell phone. So their technology that they're using to bug us, their Orwellian nightmare, Big Brother or surveillance systems, we're just turning it against them and showing them that we're watching.
What we're seeing here in 2012 represents not just an evolution of social media, of independent media, of the ability of citizen journalists to bring attention to causes that and events that the mainstream media will refuse to cover.
You have thousands and thousands of people watching live stream video. You know, they're interested. People are dying for real information, truth.
We are able to pretty much broadcast to the world to thousands of people live, unedited, uncut, as everything's happening, pretty much just through a cell phone. It's, you know, we're living in amazing times. The technology is advancing.
It's like more than it's a protest. It's almost an independent media summit. You know, there are at least 20 cameras here live streaming, not all like with some central hub. No, 20 independent media outlets, 20 individuals doing separate live streams.
We are making a difference. We are forcing the mainstream media to cover these events, you know, and they are coming kicking and screaming, but they are coming.
If you had an opportunity to maybe say a short little message to the people in that room, the people sitting around that table, what might you say to them?
That's a hard question.
It's a tough one, I know. It's a tough one. I don't mean to put you on the spot. It is.
Second. But if I could say anything to the Bilderbergers is, when you do things in darkness, they will come to the light, and they are. We're here just to shine that light. I don't hate you. I'm not going to spend my energy just to negatively go after you, but I will expose you, and I will talk to you, and I will communicate with you with words to try to make you and the world understand that there's a lot more going on than we actually know, and we deserve to know what's happening. We're human beings. We're just as equal as you, and we're all in this world together.
My message to the globalist is the sleeping giant that is humanity is awakening. It's 1776 against their 1984 worldwide. Their system of 1984 against the spirit of liberty, and they will be defeated, and they know it, and they're starting to run scared, and they should be, because information is power. And the truth is setting us free.
We know who you are, and we're taking our fate back.
We know who you are, and we're going to expose you all the way. So we're not stopping. We're going to be growing in numbers 100 times this in the future. So just wait. Just wait. We're coming.
I'm sure you guys realize, you know, that this is the fate of the planet. You guys are in control one way or another. People are finding out what's going on.
Life is short. We should live it to the fullest and treat people with respect, honesty, dignity, and compassion. And you could change your life in any moment, any time, and just think about the decisions you're making and how they affect people and how they hurt people, and understand there's real consequences for those decisions that you guys have made, that you guys will have to live with for an eternity, pretty much.
When Jesus was tempted in the wilderness, Satan said, if you bow down and worship me, I will give you the world. Well, guess what? You've got the world, and we're not going to bow down and worship you. Those filthy deeds that you have done in secret are now being shouted from the housetops. We are on to you.
The reach of the Bilderberg Group extends to every level of the policy apparatus in both the private and public sectors. Its members over the years have been the most influential and powerful individuals in the world. Whether or not they act in concert with each other or simply influence one another through these meetings is beside the point. The decisions made by each of these individuals have a ripple effect for the rest of the world. For every action, there is an equal but opposite reaction. The creation of this new Orwellian technotronic society has spawned a new generation of warrior, information warriors, whose weapons are the very technologies created to enslave them. As the old forms of media slowly die away, This generation is finding new and exciting ways to spread information, open dialogue, and become the true citizen media. The Bilderberg Group and the individuals that attend are now facing a revolutionary adversary, an informed citizenry armed with the right questions and looking for the true answers.